Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
What costs money? It's the bandwidth, basically.
This is our website.
I'm Valentina Powers. I'm an interactive producer. During breaking news stories is when most people log into our streams online.
Now let's take a look.
The more requests we get, the more we have to pay.
Help us to be there for you when you need us the most. Support podcasts by becoming a member now. Pledge online at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
So Mexico goes to the brink of legalizing just about every kind of mind-altering substance you can think of. Pot, heroin, cocaine, peyote, ecstasy. And then Vicente Fox does a last-minute flip-flop and says, let's reconsider. We'll find out why in just a minute with the LA Times Mexico City Bureau Chief Hector Tobar, and also talk about Tobar's best-selling book, Translation Nation. We'll do that in just a minute. First, we are now embarking on WNYC's annual spring membership drive, and I want to invite you to join us. So maybe right now or maybe a little later, you'll take a minute to support WNYC, New York Public Radio, to help us pay the bills for the next year and to ensure that this program and everything else you might listen to on the station will continue. If you're new to this, it's pretty simple and straightforward. We ask all our regular listeners to make a once-a-year donation to keep nonprofit news and information radio alive in the New York area. The average pledge in recent years is right around $100, so we will really appreciate it if you do that today on the phone or on the web. And everyone who pledges will be automatically entered in our drawings this weekend to win an iPod Hi-Fi, a video iPod, or a MacBook Pro. So make a tax-deductible contribution at WNYC.org. You'll see how right on the homepage at WNYC.org, or you can call 1-888-376-WNYC. That's 1-888-376-9692. And thank you so much in advance for your pledge during the Brian Lehrer Show in our spring membership drive. Thanks again. Now, Fox's flip-flop on legalizing drugs and the book Translation Nation. Hector Tobar is the Mexico City Pulitzer Prize-winning bureau chief for the LA Times. His national bestseller, Translation Nation, about Latino identity in the United States, is now out in paperback. We'll talk about the book and about the news. Hector, thanks so much for joining us from, I understand, Guadalajara today. Hello from New York.
Hello from Guadalajara. It sounds like the weather's about the same here in Guadalajara as it is in New York right now.
Well, then I consider us lucky. So Mexico's Congress passed this drug legalization bill, and President Fox had said he would sign it. Then at the 11th hour, he changed his mind. What happened?
Well, what happened was that the U.S. and international media picked up this story, and there was a lot of outrage from the Bush administration, from the United States Embassy here in Mexico, and also a lot of legislators who had signed this bill were not aware at the last minute that some important changes had been made to it that did in effect make Mexico into another Holland, into a little corner of Scandinavia as far as its drug tolerance for drugs was going to be. So all this the process of 24, 48 hours of this news spreading throughout the world. Fox decided that it was bad publicity for Mexico, that Mexico would become a haven for people to come and do drug tourism, and he reversed himself.
You mentioned fear that it would become another Holland. Was part of the intent to establish a kind of narco-tourism industry where people would come to get high legally like they do in the Netherlands?
No, not at all. There had been actually a bit of confusion. There was a provision in the law that would have essentially allowed people who could prove that they were drug addicts to possess a certain amount of drugs so that the police wouldn't harass them. And the idea being that you can take your state and local police, and instead of giving them this opportunity to go and bust regular users so they can get bribes from the regular users, take away that part of their work and allow them to concentrate on the real big drug traffickers, the people who are, you know, transporting tons and tons of marijuana and cocaine in the United States, and which have transformed several parts of Mexico into battlegrounds. The states of Guerrero and Michoacán in the south, the cities of Nuevo Laredo especially. Every year there are approximately about 1,000 drug-related murders in those parts of the country, if not more. So the idea was, let's forget about the small-time users. Let's concentrate on the people who are dealing large amounts of drugs. And the bill also included several provisions that would have allowed state and local authorities to make drug arrests for the first time. So it was part of this comprehensive package, which would have given law enforcement, local law enforcement, more tools to fight the drug trade. And this provision was included, and it ended up becoming the focal point of the entire bill.
How would you describe drug use and drug abuse in Mexico compared to the United States?
I think that there is increasingly a problem here of what they call narcomenudeo, of small-time drug sales throughout the society. I would say up until 10, 15 years ago, drug use here was something that was not widespread, among poor people, among working class people. Increasingly, there's a market for crack cocaine, marijuana has always been present here. But so increasingly, you're seeing more and more use of cocaine on the street level, and that's a source of concern for many people. But Mexico, really, the drug problem here is still the problem of the cartels that are shipping so many tons of cocaine into the United States and really have taken over a couple of states of Mexico, especially the city of Nuevo Laredo, where I was recently, where the press has been effectively muzzled. Reporters and editors are under constant death threats. There's talk of newsrooms being infiltrated by the cartels. So really the drug cartels are almost a parallel power in this country right now.
By the way, are there really enlightened rural Mexicans running around the desert achieving spiritual nirvana on peyote, or is that just the stuff of old Carlos Castaneda books?
Well, I haven't had a chance to, take a trip through those areas that he wrote about so many years ago. I'm sure that there probably are someplace. You could probably find some old man, some grizzled old man with bad teeth who will, take you to meet all those spirits. And, under the provisions of this bill, you could have owned almost 2 or 3 pounds of peyote without any problems at all, but I think it's going to be reversed.
Why do you think it took so long for the U.S. to pressure Fox? There have been articles in the last couple of days after this bill was making its way through the Mexican Congress for some time about Washington expressing its concern, about the mayor of San Diego speaking up. Why do you think it took up until this 11th hour?
Well, there's a sort of diplomatic respect that has to, be followed, because it's the United States does not want to be seen as getting involved in the Mexican legislative process, right? The same way that the Mexican government is very cautious not to make any comments on any bill pending before the Senate or the House of Representatives or that might reach George Bush's desk. It's the United States is really the big bad brother of Mexico. It's sort of this, and Mexico's little brother, and the little brother it gets upset when the big brother comes and says, hey, you shouldn't do this, you can't do that. So for at least U.S. diplomats have to try to respect that line of not becoming involved in Mexican domestic affairs. At this point, however, the bill had been approved by both houses of the Mexican Congress. It was on Vicente Fox's desk. It seemed like it was about to become law, and I think that's when the outcry really became loudest and when the Mexican government couldn't ignore it.
Hector Tobar, my guest on WNYC from Guadalajara. He's the Mexico City Bureau Chief for the L.A. Times, and we'll also talk about his book, Translation Nation, in a little while. Hector, new topic. On Monday in this country, as of course you know, there was the Day Without Immigrants boycott and rallies. But in Mexico City, on the same day, an estimated 90,000 workers rallied in a huge May Day protest against President Fox for, they said, failing to lift up the working class there. Can you tell us about that protest? Why are Mexican workers unhappy with Vicente Fox?
Well, May Day is a traditional holiday here, and there are always trade union demonstrations. There have been for a century. The Mexican trade union movement, Mexican working people, are upset with Vicente Fox because they feel NAFTA has cost them jobs. They feel NAFTA it hasn't really brought the benefits that they expected. It's cost the Mexican rural sector tremendously because Mexican farmers can't compete with Nebraska corn producers, for example. So working people in general here are very are sort of exhausted with the Fox regime, the Fox administration. Economic reform has been very thorough here in this country. The banking sector has opened up. There's more, accessibility to, loans, and there's more choice than ever before. But people don't really feel their lives have changed that much. And, in fact, this is what's been fueling the candidacy of the leftist candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the former mayor of Mexico City, whose campaign I'm actually following here in the state of Jalisco today. And so I think there's just a general sense that, yes, we've opened up ourselves to the world economy, but what has it brought Mexico? It hasn't really brought the average Mexican working person very much, and that's why so many thousands of people head north each day to try to run across the Sonora Desert to make it into the United States.
This presidential election, some of the listeners may not know, Vicente Fox's term limited out, and this lefty mayor of Mexico City, who you mentioned, is a leading candidate. I understand he's trailing slightly in the polls at this point, but is the debate there about giving up on the IMF, U.S., free market approach to fighting poverty and go the way of Venezuela and Bolivia?
It's certainly a theme in the campaign of this López Obrador, the lefty candidate, as you say. He mentions globalization in almost all of his speeches. It's a theme of his campaign. I think there's a sense, however, that many of the economic reforms cannot be rolled back, that Mexico cannot become an island, that Mexico has to remain linked to the global economy. However, I think Mexico wants to improve the terms of its connection with the United States especially. So it's something that is definitely an undercurrent here in Mexico as much as it is in many countries in Latin America, especially Argentina and Brazil, all those countries that have elected leftist candidates in Bolivia. Perhaps the sentiment here isn't quite as anti-American as it is in South America, but there's definitely an element of antagonism, of frustration among the Mexican people.
I want to read to you from a commentary by Bill O'Reilly on Fox News Wednesday night, last night. And this is not particular to Bill O'Reilly. This echoes what a number of people are saying publicly in the United States. But this is headlined, "Why Aren't Millions of Mexicans Demonstrating in Mexico City?" And it says 40% of Mexicans live below the poverty line. The hourly median wage is under $2 an hour. In addition, corruption in Mexico is so pervasive. So why aren't millions of Mexicans demonstrating in Mexico City, forcing their government to clean things up? And this is a theme, as I said, not just from Bill O'Reilly, but from many other commentators, in response to the big demonstrations in the United States, because people don't want to leave their homes if they don't have to in order to find decent work. So they say, why aren't they demonstrating that? Well, I think you were just telling us that at least on Monday, with 90,000 in the streets of Mexico City, they in fact are.
Yes, there is definitely a rumbling of discontent, especially in the southern part of the country, which is the poor part of the country. But the real reason why there isn't a revolution in Mexico, given all the corruption, given the fact that despite the fact that the Mexican state in many areas is a hostage to drug cartels, the reason why that doesn't happen is because Mexico has a safety valve. Whenever the pressure here gets pretty tight in the social pot, they just open up the valve at the top, and that valve at the top is called the United States border, right? And so the people who are most restless, ambitious for themselves, for their families, all those people are either already in Los Angeles or San Antonio or New York or Detroit, or headed there, or thinking of going there, in the next few years when things get tough. That is Mexico's safety valve. Mexico's safety valve is that it exports its ambition, its restlessness north of the border. And that's why all those people are demonstrating now in the United States instead of demonstrating here.
Interesting. So you're saying that this is actually part of the policy of Fox and probably, I'm sure, previous Mexican governments to in fact, try to move their poverty problems north of the border onto us.
It's not a conscious policy. And you're absolutely right. It's something that's across the board of the Mexican political establishment. It's just sort of a given. It's something that has operated now for a couple of generations with large numbers of people migrating. it's the sort of thing that everyone in the Mexican political class accepts. You know, that's going to be something that allows us to keep the control of the situation, is the fact that so many people are allowed to migrate to the United States. Because we also have to admit that it's a two-way relationship. Those people migrate because there are jobs waiting for them. There are people who want to hire them, right? So it's an equation with two people participating on both sides of it, and there is a general sense among the Mexican political class that that's just the way things are. There's only a few commentators who've come forward and said, hey, you know, the door's not going to be open forever. We're going to have to deal with some of these problems, rural poverty, unemployment, etc. And if we don't, sooner or later, the door is going to be totally shut.
We'll continue in a minute with Hector Tobar, Mexico City bureau chief for the L.A. Times, a Pulitzer Prize winner. His book, Translation Nation, compared to De Tocqueville by the author of Schindler's List. And we'll talk more about that when we continue with Hector Tobar, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Hector Tobar, Pulitzer Prize-winning Mexico City bureau chief for the L.A. Times. His book, Translation Nation, was a national bestseller in hardcover last year. Maybe you read it. Now it's out in paperback from Riverhead Books. It chronicles Tobar's reporting on Latino communities, from the obvious places like New York and L.A. to the very surprising like Dalton, Georgia and Rupert, Idaho. No less than Thomas Keneally, author of Schindler's List, called Tobar a new Tocqueville for our time. So we'll continue now with Hector Tobar. And Hector, some of what you wrote in this book has new currency with the immigration debate in such high relief these days in the United States, obviously. For example, you use the phrase Latin Republic of the United States to describe the emerging Latino nation within the U.S. How much do you mean to say it's kind of a separate republic?
Well, I think it's a group of people who have values that you would recognize as American in terms of their ambition, of what they dream of making their communities. But at the same time, it's a community that is very Latin American, that embraces a sense of collectivity. And in that sense, it's a much different kind of country than the country that I grew up in 1960s and 70s, Los Angeles. It's a community that is much more comfortable. It's much easier to organize a million Latinos to go on the streets of Los Angeles than it is to get maybe 5,000 people to sign a petition, because that's the way Latin American politics, that's the way Latin American culture acts. It acts in groups. It embraces that idea of collectivity. So I think rather than sort of becoming a separate country, it's really the melding of two different cultures, of Latin American history now sort of taking place north of the border in a country that has its own very rich democratic traditions, but which are becoming melded with these Latin American traditions.
You write about what you see as the old, and you even call it New York-based, style of assimilation, which had to do more with giving up the old country altogether and becoming as American as possible, compared to even your own immigrant father from Guatemala, who actually insisted that you always speak Spanish at home, you write. Why did your father insist on that?
Well, he didn't want to lose that part of his identity. He thought that English was the language of success, of achievement, but at the same time, Spanish was the language of our soul, and that I needed to know where I was from. I needed to know that our family had a history in this country, Guatemala, that it had a coup, in the CIA-backed coup in 1954, that had a history of struggle, and he didn't want me to lose that part of myself. And I thought that that was a very sort of unique choice in 1960s California, 1960s America. But in the last generation or so, the last couple of decades, that's become increasingly the choice that people of Latin American descent make, is to keep alive that cultural link to the South, to keep alive as much as possible the language, to keep alive as much as possible the traditions of Latin America. And I think that's what we're seeing now in the United States, and not just in Los Angeles and New York and Miami, but also, like you say, in places in the American heartland where there are many cities, many smaller cities that now have close to Latino majorities like Liberal Kansas or Dalton, Georgia.
My guest on WNYC, Hector Tobar, LA Times Mexico City Bureau Chief. His book, Translation Nation. And we can take some phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Of course, we've been in our spring fundraiser today. We will never ask you for money on the phone, on the air. 212-433-WNYC. If you want to talk about any of the things that Hector Tobar has been talking about this morning, the drug legalization bill in Mexico, the demonstrations there on Monday, even as there were demonstrations here on Monday, the Mexican elections coming up, or his book and some of the themes that he raises in Translation Nation, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So despite your father's insistence that you speak Spanish at home, you've obviously grown up speaking flawless English as well, without the trace of an accent even. So being asked to keep it in Spanish at home didn't make English harder for you to master?
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, I think the opposite happened. My Spanish, by the time I was 14 or 15, had atrophied. You know, I never learned, for example, the subjunctive tense, the tense in Spanish by which you express uncertainty, right? Mm-hmm. I never learned that in Spanish until I got to college. And it wasn't until I got to college that I learned how to read in Spanish, you know. And in fact, by the time I was 15 or 16, I spoke Spanglish, which is the language I think that a lot of people are speaking now in cities like Los Angeles and Miami, where you mix, you do this sort of free mixing of the languages. So for me, Spanish was something that I had to relearn when I got to college. And I came here to Mexico for a year abroad in Mexico City at the UNAM, the National University of Mexico. And I was introduced for the first time to literature in Spanish, to Pablo Neruda, to Octavio Paz, to Juan Rulfo. And, I felt, oh, this is this intellectual tradition that was denied to me because I was educated in American public schools. Mm. So I reverse assimilated. I assimilated back into Latin American culture and back into Spanish as a language, and I think that's a process that a lot of people of my generation have undergone, where they were born in one country, the United States, where English was such a powerful force and assimilation was such a powerful force, and then to have come of age now in a country where there is so much Spanish all around us, where Spanish is the top rated, the Spanish language television station is the top rated station in Los Angeles, where you can turn on the radio station in Miami and hear nothing but Spanish. You can hear classic salsa in Miami and classic rancheras in San Antonio. And so when you're in that society, that milieu that has so much Spanish, and you feel that there's a part of yourself there, you want to learn that language again. And I have many friends who have gone back to Latin America to embrace their Spanish heritage. And I think that's sort of now a feature of American society.
Let's take a call. Frank in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Frank.
I find the explanation as to why the president of Mexico reneged on making drugs illegal.
Legal.
I find that explanation not credible because, he is the president of Mexico. I'm sure he thinks these things through, and suddenly he decides that he realizes that Mexico is going to become the Holland of North America. I mean, I think he must have been under tremendous pressure from the United States, and that's why he reneged.
Yeah, so for those of you just joining us and missed the earlier part of the discussion, Mexico was on the verge of making small amounts of just about any kind of drug, heroin, cocaine, marijuana, ecstasy, peyote, legal for personal use. President Fox had said he would sign the bill. It did pass the Congress, and now he's going back on it. So Hector, Frank finds the description, you know, he's a little incredulous here and thinks that this, rather than just suddenly reconsidering something that he had obviously given a lot of thought to previously, he must have come under sudden intense pressure from the United States. What do you think?
No, I think that's absolutely right. We're talking about a cultural divide here that is actually a lot wider than people probably realize. In general, in Latin America, there isn't sort of this sense of punitive justice. Most countries south of the border don't have the death penalty, for example. A 15-year sentence for murder is considered to be a long jail sentence, 15, 20 years. There isn't a sense that the law should be punitive. So I think that there were certain elements in the Mexican legislative process that sort of thought that this was a good idea, that we, and it's also occurring in the United States. There are certain people who think that certain drugs should be legalized, because so we can concentrate really on the larger problem of what the drug trade is. That was the thinking here in Mexico. The thinking was that this is a more esoteric part of the law that we're really sort of focusing on giving more law enforcement tools to state and local officials. As part of this deal, the people who believe that there should be some legalization were given this provision. But yes, definitely, I agree with you that Fox was probably under enormous pressure from the United States, from American public opinion also, to reverse his position.
Maria Helena in Morristown, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. I can't believe that I am talking on the air. I listen to your show with the few minutes I always drive from work.
I'm really glad.
I am one of those proud American citizens who were born abroad. I was from Colombia, mm-hmm. from Bogota. And I am a mother of two beautiful children. And I married my husband from Ecuador here. We met in church. We are immigrants both. And I wanted to be on the march. I couldn't. But I want to tell everybody who's listening that it's okay to raise your children with our culture because that gives it a unique approach. And I want to do what your guest's father did, being able to teach them the language, our language, but also to be so proud of where we are because this is their country where they are growing. But the world is so small, and they will have to go to places and respect each other's cultures. So it's very important in the history that this is happening. We need to come to the understanding that frontiers are very minimal nowadays, and God knows what happened with the epidemic coming up. So let's be happy, let's love each other, and we'll see what comes. You know, just life is too short.
Right.
And besides, it's only power. People who make decisions, like a drug situation right now in Mexico, they are just mm-hmm. politics that they have to be made. But we, the people, are the ones who have to leave those politics. So I invite everybody to love each other and see that God is everywhere, no matter what color it is.
Hector, right. Anything you want to say to Maria Helena?
Well, just listening to her talk, it reminds me, and of her wanting to go to the demonstration, it reminds me of the demonstrations and also of the idea that really all of this activism, you see the mobilizations, are really a renewal of the American spirit. From the way I see it, I love American history. I've been a student of American history for since I could read. You know, it was one of the things that my father encouraged me was to learn about American history when I was 8 or 9 years old. And you know, just as the Germans and the Italians and the Eastern Europeans and the Jews transformed the United States into a new country in the process of becoming Americans, I think that the Latin American people who have come here and who are embracing the idea that they can become members of the American civic debate, that is really a renewal of the American spirit, and it really should be embraced that way.
Bill in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC.
Hi. Mexico is having all kinds of problems, of course, and it's always had all kinds of problems.
Right.
Do you think it might be a good idea if we returned Texas and California to Mexico, areas that we stole from them? Then we'd have much less trouble.
Then they'd have more trouble.
They would definitely have. You know, I think that Mexico has enough trouble running the 30 or so states of the, you know, the United Mexican States, as they're officially known. I don't really see that.
Well, Bill's being sarcastic, obviously, but it kind of goes to, you know, your phrase, the Latin Republic of the United States, which scares a lot of non-Hispanics who might feel threatened by this idea of a massive influx of Latin Americans who are, in fact, not in the process of becoming loyal to the United States like older immigrants did, or who might turn us into Canada with Spanish America being like French Quebec with all the strife that implies. Are you saying that you think that is happening?
Not quite. I think that what's happening is that Spanish is becoming sort of a language of intimacies, of family dialogues in certain parts of the United States. I think that long term, what you're going to see is that in certain cities, English becomes more Spanishified, if I could use that word. That in the same way that if you think about, you know, New New York and you think about the 19th century and the 20th century, and you think about what Brooklyn and New York English sounded like and how that sort of became, in a certain sense, this kind of American trope that was repeated in several cities across the United States. In the same sense that that's going to happen in Los Angeles is going to develop this sort of odd Spanglish that's going to become something that's reproduced in lots of American cities where there is this constant influx of Spanish, but I think English will remain always the language of government, the language of education, the language of business, the language of success. It's the way you measure how successful you are as an immigrant is how much English you can speak and how much English is part of your job, for example, or part of the education of your kids. I think we're going to see more Latin American kinds of organizing, more mass demonstrations, perhaps a greater emphasis on class in American politics than there has been in a century, because I really feel that the class divisions in the United States are becoming sharper, the middle class is shrinking, and then increasingly working class America is going to take its cues from Latin American styles of organizing.
So here, I think, is the contrast with some older immigrants. Richard in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
Hello.
Hello?
Go ahead, yes. Richard. We have about 30 seconds for you.
Okay. My parents come from Italian backgrounds. They insisted I speak English, go to school, and I was successful. I went to college and did okay. And it bothers me when I hear that other nationalities should respect other cultures. I think this is the culture. And assimilation, I think, is one way to love each other rather than insist on having a two- or three-language city.
Did you say that your parents insisted that you do not learn Italian?
Correct. Wow. They said you will learn English, you will go to school, you will get a good job, and you will be part of America.
So what do you say to the previous caller, Maria Helena, who said she's proud to be in this country and proud of her heritage, she's going to teach her children Spanish and make sure they learn good English?
I think it leads to separation.
Even that leads to separation?
Yeah.
Well, Hector, briefly?
Well, I think that one of the reasons why people are increasingly embracing their roots, their Spanish language roots, is because they feel, in a certain sense, rejected by American society. The machine of assimilation that your caller remembers, that I remember from my childhood, has in many ways broken down. The public education system in many large cities with immigrant populations has been overwhelmed, and there hasn't been the massive investment that those education system needs. So I think that people are embracing their local identity, their Latin American identity, as a sort of sense of self-defense, of a way of having our dignity, despite the fact that we live in a situation very often where we're, you know, second-class citizens or second-class residents. And that's just a general global phenomenon. Globalization has made local identity stronger instead of weakening them. And I think that if there is more of an investment in the immigrant communities, there will be more assimilation. And it's just an equation that just isn't balanced that way right now.
Well, these are overwhelmingly complicated issues, and we continue to get many points of view on them. Today with Hector Tobar, the Mexico City Bureau Chief of the L.A. Times, and our varied callers. Hector's book, Translation Nation, was a national bestseller in hardcover last year. It's now out in paperback from Riverhead Books. Hector, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.